Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi?
Sci-Fi.
Yes, sci-fi, sci-fi, sci-fi. And this week, we are talking about Ready Player One by Ernest Cline, released 2011. Who chose this one?
It is I.
Who are you?
I am me.
Good. Who narrated it?
Will Wheaton.
Oh, I think I've heard of him. Didn't he play Spock?
Something like that. He was pretty good, though. He had that rainbow thing on.
Yes,
exactly. He does a good android.
He does.
I think, well, wasn't that from The Wars or something? Star Wars?
He does. Yes. Sorry. No, I'm just busy trying not to say, so did Tasha Yar. But apparently I'm failing.
Yes, your lips were moving when the words came out.
Anyway. All right. Now, it looks like we're just going to be reading the back of the book and then saying goodbye.
It is amazingly huge back of the book.
I think it's the whole book.
Yes. It does leave out some of the finer 80s nostalgia points.
It does give you the overview, and this is the one on the original version that I have, so it's good.
All right, okay, folks, lock in. This is going to be a bumpy ride.
Yes, phasers, whatever. At once wildly original and stuffed with irresistible nostalgia, Ready Player One is a spectacularly genre-busting, ambitious, and charming debut, part quest story, part love story, and part virtual space opera set in a universe where spell-slinging mages battle giant Japanese robots, entire planets are inspired by Blade Runner, and flying DeLoreans achieve light speed. It's the year 2044, and the real world is an ugly place. Like most of humanity, Wade Watts escapes his grim surroundings by spending his waking hours jacked into the Oasis, a sprawling virtual utopia that lets you be anything you want to be, a place where you can live and play and fall in love on any of 10,000 planets. And like most of humanity, Wade dreams of being the one to discover the ultimate lottery ticket that lies concealed within this virtual world. For somewhere inside this giant networked playground, Oasis creator James Halliday has hidden a series of fiendish puzzles that will yield a massive fortune and remarkable power to whoever can unlock them. For years, millions have struggled fruitlessly to attain this prize, knowing only that Halliday's riddles are based in the pop culture he loved, that of the late 20th century. And for years, millions have found in this quest another means of escape, retreating into happy, obsessive study of Halliday's icons. Like many of his contemporaries, Wade is as comfortable debating the finer points of John Hughes' oeuvre, playing Pac-Man, or reciting Devo lyrics as he is scrounging power to run his Oasis rig. And then Wade stumbles upon the first puzzle. Suddenly, the whole world is watching and thousands of competitors join the hunt, among them certain powerful players who are willing to commit very real murder to beat Wade to this prize. Now, the only way for Wade to survive and preserve everything he knows is to win. But to do so, he may have to leave behind his oh-so-perfect virtual existence and face up to life and love in the real world he's always been so desperate to escape. A world at stake. A quest for the ultimate prize. Are you ready?
Player one.
Yes.
Job on a Wookiee.
Solo.
All right. Well, as usual, we are the best and worst people to review this book.
Yes. I thought it was just the best and worst of everything.
Well, yes, that's true. That probably should be the tagline or possibly the name of the show. But anyway, let's try to do this from memory. You have been recruited by the Star League to
defend the frontier against Zur
and the Kodan Armada.
Yes, and we don't really have to work very hard. I was definitely one of those people when I first read this that I felt those people that said this book was written like
just for fun.
Me.
Yeah, oh, yes. Okay. Yeah.
For fun. Yes. It's like basically like 90% of the stuff was stuff that I was intimately familiar with. There was only a little bit of stuff that I was like, you know, hadn't watched but was familiar with. And there was like 1% that I was like, no, I don't think I've heard of that.
I mean, so yeah, the problem with me doing a review of this is my review is basically, I have successfully been pandered to.
Yes, but still awesomely pandered.
I mean, and that's what the author set out to do. You know, there are so many reviews out there that say, well, this is self-indulgent. Well, yeah, but I'm kind of the self, you know? It's just doing nostalgia, and very well.
And it's not just nostalgia, but yes, people were complaining in some cases about, oh, it's just a laundry list of all the stuff that happened in the 80s. And you
know, cross like, off just and replace it with hella awesome.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the book as well. And, you know, after listening to some of the other reviews out there, you know, and hearing the complaints about like, well, you know, I wouldn't have chosen a DeLorean with the Ghostbuster symbol on the side. I'm like, well, you know, yes, I guess you could have chosen like Airwolf instead, or, you know, the, you know, Kit, you know, and put, you know, you could, oh my God, put gull wings on it or something, just because it doesn't, you know, match up with your little, you know, view of what you wanted.
And yes, I will point out that Ernest Cline, the author of this book, did in fact write an entire poem about Airwolf.
Yes. Which is the most awesome thing ever.
The man has done spoken word about Airwolf, and really that's the core of his essence right there. The rest of it is just spiraling around.
I mean, I did find a lack of Smurfs, you know, slightly disturbing.
I find your lack of Smurfs disturbing.
Yes, thank you. I was waiting for that.
Yes, I feel Gargamel.
More of an Azrael fan myself.
Azrael, yes.
I mean, you know, if you're expecting a coherent review on this one and not just a collection of sound bites as we devolve
into
the component parts that make us individuals, then I'm afraid you're going to be disappointed. Yeah, this one is a lot of fun. It's setting out to be a lot of fun. There's something about having younger people that are as obsessed with your childhood as you are now that you are approaching middle age or have approached it and it's gone whistling by at this point. I mean, Ernest Cline was born in 1972. I was born in 1971.
Right. And I think, doesn't Holiday have the same birth date? I don't know if it gave him the same day.
Exactly. I don't think that they gave it the exact same date, but yeah, pretty close thereon. Basically, the idea is all of world culture is now obsessed with the same things that you are.
Right. And, you know, it you know, like when I first read this, it just made me incredibly happy. And I mean, it still does. I mean, honestly, I almost don't want to admit it, but I probably read this like 10 times or something like that. Yeah. In fact, I will give this as a review. I first listened to the Wil Wheaton audio version when it came out. Mm-hmm. It was probably that spawned me to buy the first book I'd bought in probably 10 years. I'm like, okay, I have to buy a copy of this just to have an actual paper copy of it. Like, so when it first came out, I like bought one. So it has never been read, but I did pull it out and take a picture of it. Because, hey, so, I don't have time to read paper.
So it's basically...
memorabilia about nostalgia.
It's meta.
It's meta. Deep.
It's meta all the way down, Steve. Yes.
And the other interesting thing was this was sort of at the leading edge of 80s nostalgia. And in fact, I'm starting to get a little nostalgic about the 2011, you know, the early 2010s when 80s nostalgia was cool.
Yes. Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, the part where people, you know, say, oh, this is, you know, there's no plot, which I don't really agree with, but I could see if you're irritated with it, you know, it's not going to put you in the mood to kind of look for the plot that's in between those bits. You know, it's like something's, that's like the structure is the nostalgia kind of.
It's got one of the most classic, we want to get the thing to get the grand prize plots.
Solve the puzzles to get the prize at the end.
I mean, it is basically an echo of Adventure, right? But we can go into that later.
And that's deliberate too.
It's of course deliberate, but the
yes, I curse this book for ruining War Games for me.
Since you hadn't seen it, I'm sure.
Oh, I'm pretty sure I saw it. But I actually do believe that like a lot of the like younger kids these days are gonna go see the movie and
they'll be like, oh man, you ruined it. Well, spoiler. They're gonna pause the movie, flash up and say, warning, War Games spoiler.
I'm also kind of wondering if they're gonna actually understand a lot of the 80s references, or is it just going to be like a big visual thing, you know, visual bonanza for them?
I don't know much about the movie because it hasn't come out yet, but that's
the trailer
tomorrow.
Has a lot of take on me.
Yeah. And I did like that version of it, but, but they basically said the plot is out the front window and all the nostalgia stuff is out of the side windows of the car, whatever, you know, the thing they're making. So there's a lot of stuff in there, but it's not like, oh, you have to know this to enjoy it. It's like, this happens to be there because that's an integral part of the book. But yeah, I was going to say that the people that kind of say, oh, this is a huge list of things and so what? I'm like, well, it kind of made me think of that, you know, that situation you get in where you're, you know, you're with a friend of yours and they like, you know, meet some old friend of theirs from high school or something that you don't know. Oh. And so you sit there for about 2 hours while they go, and remember this and remember Johnny and haha, we went to the club that time. And you're just like completely bored, irritated or whatever.
Jimmy the Fish.
Yeah. And they're just like experiencing the most awesome, like nostalgia recollection thing ever. And that's like, if you've had these experiences right. when you were a kid, that's what it's going to be like reading this book.
Right.
It's like, it's going to be the most awesome. Like just by mentioning something brings back, you know, hey, Space Giants. Oh, I watched that when I was like seven and I barely remember it, but that's awesome that, you know, made me think of it. And like,
no, but Voltron was better.
They mentioned Voltron. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's like going to somebody else's high school reunion.
Right. Basically, yeah. And so if you're on the other side, I can understand why people would be like, it's just a list of stuff. Who cares?
And it's just like, right. And I would invite you not to read this book in that case. I mean, this is what it is, like many things.
Yes. And if you're one of the people that it is destined for, then you should enjoy
it. Barry, did you have any further comments? Did this awaken your childhood in the same way it did for Kevin and I, or...
I mean, I think a lot of the computer games that he was playing definitely did. You know, like I played a lot of the old Atari games and Zork and things like that.
So you weren't one of the cool kids that played pinball, actually?
I did play pinball, but that was actually probably later, more towards my high school years. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a lot of money growing up, so it's like, you know, buying a lot of the toys, you know, like Voltron, you know, toys and things like that, we didn't have the money for, so it was sort of... I saw the cartoons and went like, oh, yeah, I'm never going to own that, so.
Oh, yes. No, there's now a Netflix show about toys, and it was interesting how closely you could, you know, I was watching it with a whole crowd of geeks in the room, and you could very carefully identify the ages that people were by what they were gasping over. Because I was freaking out about the Star Wars figures.
Right.
Because that was one of my first big toy experiences. Yeah, a lot of this stuff formed our early childhoods. And to me, it seemed like this was around the time that early childhood started to get incredibly specific. Because...
It wasn't just cowboys, Indians, and, you know, guns and whatever.
Like, right. You know, you were not playing the same games that your parents played when they were a kid. Variants of the same games.
Yeah. I mean, I remember definitely having like sort of old school army men, you know, sort of the green plastic, you know, mold guys. And, you know, on occasion I would get like a special gift or something, which was, I remember I, like for Star Wars, I had the, what is it, IG-22 or whatever, the sort of the robot assassin character for some reason, but I didn't have any of the other ones. And I was like, okay. And then, you know, one of the more interesting things is that I ended up with a few of the, you know, Transformers, you know, the original ones in the red boxes. And, you know, I kind of like grasp how kind of pricey they were at the time. And so I never took them out and they're still sitting in my closet.
Wow. That's impressive.
Okay. That could be worth something now.
Yeah.
They could be, but now that, you know, whoever's doing the Transformer movies have basically ruined the Transformers.
That reminds me, I totally forgotten until just now that I had like, I never had a Transformer, but at some point my parents had gotten me some Japanese import robot.
By the way, we may actually start talking about the book again at some point.
In a couple of minutes. And it was a similar kind of thing where it's like, you know, I only got one ever. And I remember them saying like, and if you break it, you know, basically, we don't know if you're old enough for this, but if you break it, I guess you're not. So we're going to take it away or something like that. I think it was more of a ploy just to make sure I put it all back in the box. Cause it was one of those like things that came apart and put together. So there were like about 30 pieces or something.
Wow.
And I was always like, Oh God, did I break it? Like now I realize it was just like, please don't lose the pieces.
All right. Well, I think it's time for us to go raid Barry's closet for unsold toys. While we do that, we're going to take a bit of a break. And when we come back, we're going to spoil the frightening ending of Ready Player One and also possibly of the 80s and 90s. We shall return for We Are Sci-Fi.
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 Spoiler alert. The ending of the 80s and the 90s. It's now. And welcome back to our discussion of Ready Player One. I'm doing a radio voice.
Good job.
So, yeah, we talked quite a bit about, you know, when does dropping references go over the line? The answer is, depends on who you are. If you happen to be us, then it pretty much never does.
I don't know. This one kind of nudged up against the line for me.
Oh, sorry.
I don't think it got even close for me. It's like, well, there are other D&D mods you could have mentioned. Why that one? Module, yeah. How about that one? Or, you
know. Not the Sinister Secrets of Saltmarsh.
I have it, but I have not played it.
And there wasn't enough about actual Star Wars figures in here.
That's true.
I mean, that can be fixed, of course, with a little bit, you know, really this should be a wiki and everybody should just be allowed to insert their own references.
Actually, I feel like this world would be a perfect setting for, because I can't see this being, you know, another book in the series. Like, it would have to just be other characters, but I could see it being one of those shared worlds where people write in this setting.
Well, apparently he is working on Ready Player 2.
Interesting. I had thought of, like, well, maybe, you know, Halliday comes back and there's a ghost in the machine, like they mentioned, or something like that.
Been an AI the entire time.
Yeah, or something. Or there's a bug where the thing keeps going or something.
Well, more accurately, it might be something like, you know, Halliday doesn't agree with how Wade's going to, you know, reinvent the world with all that money and, you know, works to stop him. He's now become the monster that he wanted to defeat.
Now, what was that other book that we read where they were all at a game company and...
You?
Yes, that's why I can't remember you, the name.
A novel.
So E-W-E? It seems to me like you is almost the serious version of this.
Yeah, basically, that they have the same kind of, you know, historical game forking past, basically. Like,
right. Although we did love it, there were some points that we were poking at. Yes, several of us have noted that he had a certain lack of empathy for his remaining family in the trailer park.
Yeah. So this was my first read of this book, and you know, when we got to the point where they basically, you know, detonated his aunt's trailer or something, mm-hmm. and he's like, "Oh well." I was like, well, that's kind of dark. I mean, there's still people, you know, and he had his, you know, sort of, what is it, the little old lady who lived, you know, right. down the stack or whatever right. it was.
He was far more concerned about her than...
But even then, he just kind of like blew it off, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, well, not just totally. Glad it wasn't me.
I will say that it does seem to be one of the common, you know, critiques is that he does seem kind of not very empathetic. When I reread it, I was kind of looking specifically about that, and he does break down, you know, crying when he's talking to H about it, you know, afterwards. And you could tell he basically says, I feel bad about, you know, his friend, the old lady that grew up in the 80s. He basically said, I'm not that, I mean, he basically said, you know, my aunt didn't deserve to die, but we weren't that close. So, I mean, my reading was she was like quasi abusive because he did basically say that, you know, she or like one of her boyfriends would basically like, you know, starve him. And
yeah, and, but it just made me, you know, sort of call into question the idea that even, you know, other people that he wasn't related to or didn't know personally, it's like their lives are sort of just, well, you know, it's like throwaway stuff.
But I would also say that could be a character choice, because remember back at that point, his grand plan was to escape the solar system.
Right. And so I think, and I'm trying to read that if it's a, like you said, a choice or like a kind of point that, well, they're so disconnected from reality because they all live in a video game all the time that they don't, it's sort of like being desensitized by like the news all the time or whatever, or violent video games.
Yeah.
So he's really more of a monster like I am then than I ever thought. Right. You know,
so why don't you like him more?
I just can't understand so similar a monster. You know, it's like looking in the mirror,
right?
You know, the earth is basically doomed and I'm going to leave the planet. Bye, suckers.
Yes, I can't say I've never thought of that. Like,
you I'm know. Not saying that I'm not thinking it right now.
Later, suckers.
But yeah, as opposed to Artemis, where she actually wants to use this money to help everyone.
Yeah.
Right.
And his thought is, no, it's worthless. Let's get out of here. And I mean, he was a relatively younger teenager at the time, you know, it takes a certain amount of time. I just remember I was not as empathic as a teenager as I became later on. I won't speak for other teenagers or current teenagers or people that are listening now saying, I'm really empathic and I'm going to kill you.
That maybe, seems wrong. Maybe this is more like a proto Bob from We Are Legion. We Are Bob. You know, he's going to get out of space and like finally realize, well, maybe we should go back and rescue, exactly. rescue what's left of humanity.
Yes. But he does at least have enough of a change of heart towards the end where, I mean, he's sharing the money anyway with his sort of co-conspirators. So
you want to call it that?
Co-players.
Yes.
His party, as you will.
I'm just getting ready for the future when I just refer to any group of people as unindicted co-conspirators.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I know.
I don't ever plan on being indicted.
Exactly. Thus, unindicted co-conspirators.
But yeah, actually, we don't ever really get, well, two things. I don't think we ever get what other people were going to do with the money, right? Like, we don't even find out from H what H is going to do. And I kind of was thinking too that we got a bit of the backstory for H, but for Artemis, I don't even think I had any idea what her home life was, you know, in the real world, except that she lived in Canada and like apparently she had enough money to buy a high end rig or something like that.
Right. Well, I mean, I think a lot of this book is really just about Wade, right? Which is, you know, sort of Ernest, the author in sort of like a thin disguise, right?
Oh, sure.
I mean, well, yeah, it is framed by him saying, I'm telling my story. So, it's definitely from his point of view.
Well, and I mean, you know, the view of Artemis is definitely from a male perspective. I mean, you know, that's fine. It's from Wade's perspective. He is completely besotted by her even before they've actually even met online.
It's my internet crush.
Exactly. Right. He basically is like, I was a big fan of your blog. And I do like how it kind of says like, and you know, she would post pictures of her avatar, you know, doing stuff. And he's like, and sometimes, always I would take screen caps of it to put in my Artemis folder, like Art Threemis folder.
Well, and I mean, conveniently, she turns out to be just as hot in real life, except, you know, has a birthmark on her face.
Right. So this, well,
it's also kind of creepy now that I think about it some more because, you know, like in Oryx and Crake, right, Jimmy has like the little printout of.
Yeah.
Well, I think Oryx and Crake is deliberately going a lot creepier.
Right. But so like this is the one thing.
Isn't that wholly different?
No.
I think this
depends
is
what you mean by wholly different, and it's fun to watch Kevin squirm.
I think this is, I would say that this is more innocent for sure.
Sure.
And the one thing is this book definitely deals on some levels with racial issues and other things, like, you know, with the online versus in real life and like, you know, how you can present yourself as something else with H and everything.
Mm-hmm. Referring to a character named H, not that you can present yourself with you know, in other ways.
I am the letter H
with heroin.
It's like a Sesame Street thing or something like.
Yeah, but you're more of a lowercase H. I'm more of an uppercase H.
And
Case-ist.
It is only funny that I knew someone that his nickname was Z when.
Oh, I know someone whose nickname is Z.
There are other books like Snow Crash who deals. It's funny. This is a very different view of living in a virtual world, right? Because Snow Crash, well, while it took place, you know, it was written much longer ago, like than this one. But
and this is sort of another rev of Snow Crash in some ways.
I mean, obviously, I did notice that. I think I'm pretty sure purposely in this book he mentions almost all the other virtual world names, like mm-hmm. in context for describing the Oasis. I think where he'll like he mentioned Metaverse at one point. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, they said Matrix and I think whatever, like Neuromancer terminology too, I think.
But, I'm going to kick myself later.
But I don't know what that is because I've never read Neuromancer.
I can kick you now.
We'll go into that later.
Please don't.
No, we won't. So.
I was talking to Barry.
Yeah,
but okay.
I realize that too. But but whatever. Everything is about me.
I suddenly remember I gave my mother the URL for this podcast. Hi, Mom. But more to the point, so she could give it to my cousin Tom. Hi, cousin Tom.
Hey.
If you made it this far,
we're sorry.
Yeah.
yes. So, well, I guess what I'm saying is, it's very common, normal, and almost accepted that you're going to live your life in the Oasis as like your primary interface to humanity.
Sure.
Whereas in Snow Crash, they called them gargoyles, which I had forgotten until I read it a couple years ago again.
Well, and it was specifically, kind of like, you know, people that wore the equivalent of Google Glass.
Right. But also they kind of spent their entire life in the metaverse. And that in that book, they dealt with it a slightly differently, where there was that guy who was like a war vet amputee or something like that, that sort of, you know, he had a very refined avatar, and he sort of lived in the virtual world because he kind of had a very uncomfortable existence, you know, with a lot of body pain and stuff like that.
Right. Well, I think we also have a much more different view of what the internet and virtual worlds are going to be now versus, say, you know, 20 or 25 or 30 years ago.
Right.
You know, there it's sort of, it, I think a lot of the authors sort of viewed the world as very segmented. You know, now the internet's very pervasive and deeply integrated right. into everyday life.
Right.
It's kind of hard to remember when that wasn't the case. It's really weird.
Yeah. I mean, there are still cases where people don't have internet, right?
Right.
And so this would still seem very foreign, but here in the Bay Area, it's part and parcel of everyday life. And, you know, I would also assume it's also the same thing like in major metro areas like New York and Los Angeles.
I occasionally have this thing like, you know, memory change blindness or something, or technological blindness, where I think, why was I lost then? Why didn't I just look at my phone? And then I remember that I'm remembering, say, the mid-90s when I didn't even have a cell phone,
let alone.
I mean, I definitely remember like occasions when I was, you know, fresh out of high school and I had driven someplace and gotten lost, right? And then remember having like sort of that panic that sets in. And it's like, now it's like if I drive someplace and I kind of end up someplace unfamiliar, like I take a wrong turn.
It's just like, oops.
I just look at my phone and like, hey, how do I get home? Right.
Right. Like, it's like, you don't have to worry about it.
I don't have to get out the Thomas map book and try and figure out where the hell I am.
Better prepare for the zombie apocalypse, Barry.
Yes. Which is good because I don't have a map in my car and I really should.
Yeah. I finally got one just in case, but yeah. And like we've said, this is definitely a very wish fulfillment and sort of a, while it's a very grim dystopic setting, his point of view is very optimistic, especially the way it ends up.
Right.
Throughout the whole book, Artemis is like, you know, I could have, you know, defects. I could be a horrible person. I'm just being nice to you, you know, and, you know, he was sort of joking, well, you could be some 300-pound dude named Chuck living in your mom's basement. And like, you know, which was kind of an amusing running gag that
I found it kind of interesting that stereotype, you know, still exists, that like everybody on the internet, you know, some like big fat dude pretending to be a woman, you know, and like, well, like,
I don't think that's really that common, but yeah, you could be. And they made the point several times in here that it's like, oh, you know, this is his teacher, but you know, who looks like, you know, he's always spouting Dickens and stuff, but you know, that's the way he talks, but you know, he actually could be a, you know, a small Inuit woman, you know, that, right, whatever. So that was maybe more necessary when the book was first written. Now I think it's, yes, you know that you can pretend to be somebody else on the internet. They at least dealt with the stuff with H, where, you know, he meets her and it's like, oh, okay, you're not who I expected you to be. Whereas with Artemis, and I can't fault the book for wanting to, you know, kind of have it end that way, you know, but like you said, you know, he could meet Artemis and it turns out that, you know, she's a paraplegic, that, you know, whatever. And like,
right. And then he has to sort of decide, okay,
am I really going to do what I said? Right. Or
it's really Halliday's, you know, disembodied brain in a bottle,
something like that. And I mean, on the one hand, that would be an interesting approach. On the other hand, this is kind of a wish fulfillment novel. Right.
That's kind of what I'm saying, is I'm not sad that he wrote it this way. I enjoyed the book a lot. I'm saying that it's not a hard take on, you know, decisions and stuff, but he did at least bring it up, and it was at least not just a throwaway thing. It, you know, they kind of went into, you know, H's background, and you know, while it wasn't like a central part of the book, he still dealt with, like, you know, the good and bad bits of like racial and social, you know, issues that way.
Yeah. And I'm not entirely sure that was a big thing, you know, that people were masquerading as other kinds of people back in the day. Maybe I'm not on that kind of social chat as much anymore, but nowadays with social media, then people are obsessively sharing every little aspect of their lives.
Right.
And their racial identities are often very much in the forefront of all of that. So I think that this is something where, if this were a book, we're actually trying to be predictive, which I don't think it was.
For this part, yeah.
For this part, I don't think
that this book was necessarily meant to be like a social commentary by the author.
No, it was.
I mean, there are some elements of it in there, but it was not, that was not its primary reason for being written. It's also interesting, you know, I spent about I don't know, 10 years on IRC,
right. Sure.
Right, where it's all purely text and you really didn't know what people really looked like or, you right. know, their gender or anything, right?
And you just had their username and that could be gibberish or not.
Right. And I spent, you know, like I said, about 10 years, I've only met a handful of the people from IRC, because mostly because they're from all over, literally all over the world.
Right.
You know, and they turned out to be like pretty wildly different than what I had imagined just based on, you know, what they were saying.
Right.
You know, it's also interesting that like for a lot of like IRC usage, people were very protective of their identity, right? They right. didn't like, and most people didn't go out spamming out pictures of themselves like they do on Facebook uh-huh. these days. So
right.
I wonder what changed, right?
Mm-hmm. I think for me, the difference is social media started encouraging that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so rather than trying to change yourself to look like some kind of ideal of your own, you know, people are being encouraged to share. I won't say who they really are because that is a very beset concept, but they're...
Well, it's their public facing persona that right. they're sharing, right?
People are very much more creating their own public facing persona in different ways, I guess.
It's like, hi, I'm a psychopath and I'm advocating for the end of the world.
Good job. We're almost there.
Is that a little too truthy?
I mean, there's no need to advocate for it. It just happens.
You just can sit there and wait.
Yeah, it takes too long.
That seems to be kind of what's, you know, the dystopic setting in the book feels pretty familiar. It's worse than it is now, but it feels like it's easily going to slide in there if things can, you know, it can be nudged slightly in one direction. Hey, we're there.
I absolutely love the concept of the stacks.
Yeah.
You know, especially here in the Bay Area right now, where a lot of trailer parks are disappearing and people are, you know, really advocating for more affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had sort of mentioned to one of the other city council, you know, attendees.
You're like, hey, you should be ready, player one.
I've got this business idea, you know, maybe you could help me out, that, you know, the trailer parks aren't really monetizing their vertical space very effectively. I just want to be the guy that provides like the erector set.
Right. You know, when I first read this, I was thinking that the stacks actually were like storage containers stacked up. And that may just be how I remembered it from years before. Like, but, you know, I guess it really was just RVs. But yeah, it's still high class either way. Yeah.
I've got to say, the problem with depicting this world as a utopia, that people are escaping into this bright and colorful world, is I, too, was escaping into the bright and colorful world while listening to this book. I was just right. like, hum-da-dum, yeah, no, outside stuff. Oh, they're back in the verse. Okay, great.
Well, and me being a connoisseur of dystopias and of apocalyptic media, I'm like,
where's the zombies?
No, I mean, I'm not a zombie have-to-be person. It's like a side, you know, thing. You know, it's like, eh, there's lots of good apocalypses without zombies, you know. Oh. So...
It's like, my God, why didn't she set off the bomb on the space, you know, station window?
Could have fixed everything.
Just ended humanity for the betterment of the universe.
But then no zombies.
Yes.
They could be space zombies at the end.
Of course.
Space zombies, yes.
We'll work on that.
Okay,
yes.
Let's get back to the book.
So did we figure out any of the clues for ourselves? I can't say that I really did, except for, of course, the go along with the movies you've memorized bits. I probably could have done several of those.
Oh, right. Like War Games or whatever.
Yeah. Right. Some of it, of course, is based on internal knowledge of the universe that we don't have any particular
right.
way of getting there.
Yeah. We also haven't immersed ourselves in, what was it, Halliday's Almanac or
right.
whatever sure. it is, which had probably a lot of clues that were sort of buried very deeply into it.
Yes, although, you know, we do have somewhat the advantage of having actually lived those years. And so the thing that actually made me kick myself the most was when they all got to Zork at the end.
Oh.
And I'm just like, oh, I really should have seen that one coming because I've played lots of Zork.
With the trophy case. Yeah, I didn't get that one. I played Zork, but not that much.
Mm-hmm.
The one that early on that jumped out is like, completely obvious to me was the Tomb of Horrors one, where it's like, you know, you will find blah, blah, blah in a tomb filled with horrors. And I'm like, oh, it's Tomb of Horrors.
Yeah.
I'm like, duh, what else could it possibly be?
I had no knowledge of Tomb of Horrors. Well,
yeah. But if you, you know, if
so
you
played, it's the equivalent of you are a number and your number is six. And, you know,
yes, if you play D&D, you'd be like, oh, and then, but I'm glad that it wasn't like a big, like, oh, so, you know, difficult and drawn out. They actually, you know, a paragraph later is like, and then I'd figured it out. And like, you know, I stumbled on this thing and I thought, oh, it must be this. And
yeah. Right. I think the only one that I got anywhere close to was probably the, I don't know, was it the second riddle where he's talking about a test? And I've been watching an awful lot of Blade Runner lately.
Oh,
you know, and I'm like, oh, this has got to be some sort of, you know, play on a VK test. Comp. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I didn't get that one, but that was kind of an amusing thing. Yeah. The only one from there that I got was where he says the thing about, you know, the whistle and, you know, Captain Crunch, you know, and that kind of stuff. And I'm like, oh, he's okay. Probably talking about
that was one where I was kicking myself after
the whistle. Like, you know, that was the only other one that I kind of thought, oh, that's probably what he's talking about is the 2600. Yeah. Although I didn't know the part where in the book where he says, and then I held down like the first or second thing to make the 2600 hertz tone. I'm like, okay, I didn't know enough about it to know how to play yeah. it on the whistle.
I mean, I sort of had known from, you know, my readings on the internet about, you know, the Captain Crunch whistle and mm-hmm. and things right. like that. And, you know, 2600 digest that you could go down to, you know, the,
right.
what was our local bookstore that finally closed? The computer literacy.
Yes, computer literacy.
Because I used to go down there and, you know, and buy like, you know, my copy of 2600 and, yeah, you know, yeah. not understand about half of it. But
you're like, this is so cool. Or like, yeah, you would download.
I felt very like, much like, you know, subversive literature.
Well, right. You know, the kind of like the,
yeah,
the internet.
The anarchist cookbook for the internet.
The yeah. BBS stuff that would come out and like you'd get, you know, 2600 text files and frack and all those things.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I always thought that, okay, yeah, I've got these text files. And if I wanted to be bad, then I could read them.
But I'm just storing them on disk, so I'm cool.
I'm lead. Yes. Yeah, no, I didn't really figure out too many of them myself.
Yeah, amusingly, a friend of mine who did have a Trash 80, or a TRS 80, if you will, he said, oh, yeah, I did actually play Dungeons & Daggeroth back then.
Yeah, I can't say that I ever played that. Well, I did play an awful lot of the Atari 2600 games.
You know, I did feel a sort of flashback quality because just recently as a team outing, my team went down to the Computer History Museum and we were doing a scavenger hunt inside the Computer History Museum. And so one of the clues was you have to play Pac-Man and score more than 1,000 points. And I was just thinking, okay.
Isn't that pretty straightforward?
Well, yeah, that's actually really, really easy once you get to it. But I was sort of thinking more in terms of play a completely perfect game of Pac-Man. Yes.
It's only just three. Like,
oh, does anybody here play Pac-Man?
3,360 points. Huh?
Did you remember to pull up a video of somebody else playing it and follow along?
I will say, I wouldn't call it in my research for this book, but while we were reading it, I did watch a YouTube video of someone playing a perfect game of Pac-Man, and watch is a loose term. I had it on while I was doing other things because it was about 5.5 hours long. So I didn't sit there for 5.5 hours going, whoa, 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 whoa. But I did have it on, and then I paused it, and the next day I'm like, oh, hey, I'll put that on again as like my background music, basically.
Wah, 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 wah.
I believe it's more waka, waka, waka.
Well, I was waiting for it to get to the 256th level where there's actually like at the California Extreme, you know, arcade show, there's something called like Pac-Man 256 or something where someone's like, you know, made a hacked version of the ROM where it starts at level 255 or something. So you can get to that, that point. And I never actually could get to that point.
Yes. Oh, and I do wonder if the Oasis was a reference to the Oasis, the hamburger joint that the Homebrew Computer Club used to meet at.
Is Ernest a local?
Mm-hmm.
Is Ernest a local?
I don't know. I'm not entirely sure. I don't think he is.
Otherwise, I think we'd cyber stalk him.
I think we would have met him.
Well, it's only weird because, yeah, he did mention a lot of, you know, stuff like Space Giants, Ultraman, stuff that was on like, you know, the Channel 2, you know, what was it, Creature yeah. Features or whatever it was sure. called.
I mean, I definitely remember watching a lot of Ultraman on Channel 2 and as a kid.
Yeah.
And then he may very well have been a Bay Area kid. I don't know.
Or it might have been syndicated somehow too. I don't know. But
Ernest, if you're listening, please let us know.
Knock twice. All right. Moving on, because we have to go away from here eventually. So did we have favorite scenes?
Probably my favorite scene was when, you know, the extra life is used for him, or he uses extra life quarter artifact. And I mean, it was the first time I listened to the book, you know, of course I'm like, I didn't know that was happening. And it's like, you know, it's like, and then everybody died and you're just like, oh crap, what's going to happen now? It's like, you know, and you're waiting for something. At this point, you know, he's done this side quest essentially and it's for apparently nothing. And then it's something like, oh, bloop. And then, you know, congratulations, you have an extra life. And like, when I first read that, I was like, this is so fucking awesome. Like, you know, basically. And like, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, I don't even want to admit, like, you know, how like excited I was basically, like when that I'm like, oh, I mean, it just felt like a cool way to kind of, you know, have that happen, you know, because like he had to do this. And actually that's kind of like, you know, this is like a side quest, right? It has nothing to do with the hunt, but it was like a cool little thing that he threw in. And that's like kind of how I like playing role-playing games, is in the computer games anyway, is like, you know, I kind of, I don't center on the side quest, but I usually just kind of do whatever I want.
Sure.
And so it's like, I end up doing a lot of the side quests before I do the main quest, just because, you know.
Yeah. So were you guys completely blindsided by the extra life showing up later?
I don't remember if it blindsided me the first time that I read it, or
I mean, because as soon as he got the extra quarter, you know, having spent a lot of time in my childhood in an arcade, I was like, oh, it's an extra life at some point, you know, when is it gonna? And then they had kind of mentioned the giant artifact that annihilated everybody in the in the sector.
Yeah, I honestly cannot remember whether I knew that, because I was trying to remember that, whether I was excited because I'm like, oh, I knew it was going to be that, or whether I just was happy that that happened. And I honestly can't remember if I predicted it or not.
Well, as soon as he said like he couldn't, you know, he didn't have time to examine it right away, and it just kind of got shuffled away. Right. You're I was like it's important. It's going to come up later, and it's going to,
I will say that scene was one thing where they, you know, as we say, it was wish fulfillment, and there weren't a lot of consequences for it, where it's like, oh, I'll fly up there as Ultraman. Oh crap, I used it. It's like, you know, the alternate ending is where like IOI wins, because he had to like, you know, be cool for 3 minutes to play Ultraman and kick his ass. And like when he could, if he had saved it, he would have been able to go in there. Right.
Horrible, like, horrible alternate ending. Sorrento flies in from the next sector over, and he gets a ladder out of his bag, and he's like, haha, watch this.
Yeah. He's like, too bad you decided to kick my ass. Well, do you feel better now?
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, of course there had to be another way in.
Okay,
so I think my favorite, well, it's a series of scenes where it's at the very beginning of the book, where he's talking about his home life, and, you know, like he's talking about how he got his laptop, you know, taken away from his, you know, aunt's boyfriend and stuff like that. But the part that I really liked was his little van hidey hole.
Right. Oh, yeah, I really liked that part.
You know, and it that felt very nostalgic to me, and I was...
Well, you in the notes, you referenced the three investigators.
That was me.
But oh, okay.
Yeah. So I don't know if this is a reference to the book. Did you read the Three Investigators books?
No, I did.
Yeah. So
of course.
It's like the 70s set of books where there were three teenagers, and it's kind of like a more updated Hardy Boys or something. Mm-hmm. And the thing that happened in the Three Investigators was, I don't remember the details, but somehow I guess his parents lived like with a bunch of junk stacked out like in the yard, like a bunch of farm equipment or something. I don't know. But part of, they had this hideout. And the hideout was this old RV that was buried under a bunch of stuff that nobody could get to. But they figured out, oh, if you sneak in through this stuff, you can. And so they just had outfitted this old RV as their hideout. And so that totally made me think of it in here. And I don't know if that was a reference or not. But
right. There was, you know, the previous series was the Mad Scientists Club, maybe a 50s series or a 60s series, where they also had a cool hideout. I missed the Goonies. So, you know, I only saw that relatively recently as an adult, and I was too old. It was just like,
it hasn't aged well.
These kids are sociopaths.
Well, as a kid, you know, we used to have a neighborhood hideout here in the creek behind the houses, you know, before they paved it over and made it, you know, pedestrian friendly and all that bullshit. But literally you would like kind of ride your bike over this, you know, giant berm, but on the other side it was like this, you know, 30-foot drop down into the creek.
But when you had E.T. with you, you could fly.
Well, actually we just had some, you know, refrigerator boxes that we would slide down the hill on. You know, and then you'd walk up the creek, and then there was like sort of like this, you know, large drainage pipe that was no longer used. And
kids used to be free range, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes.
You know, it's, you know, other places where, you know, shoot other kids with paintballs and things like that. But run for your life, kid.
Yeah. No, the cool hideout is definitely a good invoked trope here. I really liked the sequence where he let himself be taken prisoner and
yes, then you're busted eligible out for mandatory indenturement, which really was a nice, interesting way to kind of touch on sort of how downhill the system has gone.
Right.
Where it's like, that's now, because they mentioned, you know, about, well, you know, if you couldn't get a job, you could just sign up for like a 5-year indenturement contract. And then this like, oh, well, if you don't pay your debts, then you're eligible for mandatory indenturement, which right. is, you know,
although I don't believe for a minute that they put the indentured people on their internal network. Not unless they are real idiots.
Well, yes, they.
Well, he did have to buy a hack to get into the
right
the part of the network.
He needed to have the back door. I agree that they may have been smarter than that, but they
yeah,
it's just hubris. Yeah, so,
from an 80s perspective, this was like a totally legit.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Since this is a sort of an 80s adventure story, then this is
it's like a war game.
The only way to win is to not play.
This is actually an extremely like quasi realistic thing,
right? But, where
you know
he would
working a little bit in network security. I'm just like, no, you just keep them partitioned completely off in their own thing.
Well, right. they did to the point where he, you know, sneaker netted out, you know, the, what, 10 zettabytes of, yeah. I'm like, oh, I really want a 10 zettabyte thumb drive.
Even if my thumb has to be the size of, say, my foot. Yes.
I would take a 10 zettabyte backpack drive at this point. Yes.
And, you know, that kind of went along with the whole feeling where it kind of felt very Max Headroom-y.
Sure.
With, you know, this very, you know, it wasn't
that,
to the
that
point.
That was his butler, right?
Yeah, yeah. And which is kind of like the, oh, surprise, it felt Max Headroom-y. But, you know, Max Headroom was kind of so prescient that it kind of got kicked off the air like before it even finished its first season, I think. We're just right. like, in fact, that was the most bizarre thing is like they had something like 3 or 4 episodes that they never aired because it was doing so poorly that, you know, you can get now. But, you know.
Yes. I remember watching it and, you know, like my mom was like, what is this garbage?
You're like, what do you mean? This is awesome.
I mean, I don't think there was ever a stronger reaction to a TV show, except for maybe like The Simpsons when they first came out. You know, I remember having to convince my mom to, you know, let us watch The Simpsons, you know, when, you know, we sort of noticed in the back of a Family Circle magazine that said like, hey, you know, The Simpsons are actually not that bad of a cartoon because there's always like a conflict and then there's a resolution by the end of the thing and that makes it a family show. And I'm like, we're like, look,
it's okay. Yeah. Max Headroom, I was probably the last person to actually understand that it's not even just a little bit computer graphics that Max Headroom is. It's literally just the guy in a lot of makeup.
Yeah. It was a long time until I knew that also, but considering that they did it did a reasonable job to make it look computer generated, you know,
yeah,
at the time.
Well,
I'm assuming one of you has it on DVD.
No, not yet.
Laserdisc? I don't know.
Kevin doesn't have DVDs.
I did at one point probably have them on Laserdisc. I don't know if I do now, but actually for the weirdest thing, up until about 10 years ago, you couldn't get it on DVD. I had copies when they played it on like Sci-Fi Channel or something.
What have I done?
There's a.
I mean, I know really exactly should. What I did.
Really should probably put in a rabbit hole warning at the very beginning. It's just like, yeah, given the subject matter of this episode, there is no chance that we're going to be able to stay on topic for more than about 30 seconds. So if you wanted to hear about the book, you might want to, I don't know,
just read
search
it.
For it on the internet. Or if you were born between 1969 and 1975, just skip to the end and read the stupid thing.
This episode is kind of like the same thing as this book is. It's kind of like a homage to the 70s and 80s. And I believe that if Ernest Cline ever actually listened to this, he would probably enjoy it.
Or want to kill us. Or
one of the two.
Either way, we'd love to hear from you about it.
Uh-huh. Yes. So there's only one slam against this book. As far as I know, there wasn't any tea in it.
That's what made this book awesome.
As I said, I don't think anything was actually any liquids in this book. I don't know. Although, like I was saying, the only unrealistic part, quotes, is that you could send email to all Oasis users. I mean, that's like sending email to the internet. Now, like I said, I'm willing to believe it if it costs money.
Yes. Or if you're a Russian hacker.
Well, it actually turns out that in very early incarnations of DARPANET, I guess at that point, they actually had GlobMatch for email addresses. And you could literally email *@*.
Right.
And catch everybody. But I think that was, you know, I don't know, 250, 300 people.
Yeah.
You know, and the first time it happened, they're like, don't do that. And then the second time it happened, it was, okay, we got to fix this.
I only wish that was still in the protocol.
Pretty much everybody in Philadelphia that had web pages used to have dinner together on Monday nights. And it wasn't a club. We just all knew each other.
Yeah. I mean, I can remember
that part was just a coincidence.
I don't know, very early 90s, late 80s, whatever, you know, my first actual internet account at school, and like it was only on campus internet, but we figured out you could route out by putting UCP bangs in place. So you can put your manual routes, you know, with the server bang, and then like the thing, and then it would like
actually construct it.
You would manually construct your route in the thing, and
I believe we have achieved some kind of high or low. I'm not entirely sure what.
It's actually rapidly oscillating between the two.
Yeah, it's quantum.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So which character do you want to be, and or who would you be? I think I'd go for Ogden Morrow, he was the Steve Jobs of this particular universe.
I was actually going to call him more of like a Gary Gygax of...
Sort of, yes, the Steve Jobs to Halliday's Steve Wozniak. And normally I identify far more with Wozniak, but in this case, Morrow got to sort of, you know, be the kindly uncle shepherding things along.
Yeah, it's hard not to say that you want to be Wade, but he didn't have a very good childhood, so I don't know. Like you said, Og was an obvious one. And, you know, like I'd probably end up, you know, being Halliday and just like, you know.
Well, we all are kind of Halliday. We're alternate versions of Halliday that didn't stumble upon the exact right way of, you know, creating the metaverse.
It's the one where they're like Og and Halliday are, you know, transporter melded. And,
and it's like a Tuvix.
Yes, basically.
I hate that.
So, and I think the answer is if I ever actually did anything I thought about, I would maybe be one of those two. But otherwise, I just sort of think about awesome things and don't actually do them. I would be iRock, I guess. Not that bad, though.
So I'm fairly sure that you guys think that I would want to be Sorrento. I mean, I always kind of find it entertaining to see what you guys think I would be.
Don't you want to be Artemis?
Yeah.
I don't know.
She's... yeah, maybe it could be... let's see. Who could I... I'm not entirely sure. I think you're Wade, actually.
Oh, you think I should be Wade?
Yes.
All right. I could roll with that.
Mm-hmm. Especially in the beginning when he has no sense of empathy.
Zing. Yeah, but in the end, I basically get a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I'm okay with that.
I thought you would be.
I mean, Sorrento's got all his, you know, internet crime, right? I mean, and real life crime, too.
That's true. He did order several people to be killed, so he's not a nice person.
Okay, yeah. The other thing that I liked was the part where Wade said, okay, yeah, I'll join if they kick you out right now.
And I get to be in charge.
And I get to be in charge.
He's like, do you have to ask your bosses or are they listening right now? He's like, they're listening, damn it. Like
they're listening.
He's like, and they say agreed.
Yes. Just like, nah, never mind. Just like, I just thought I'd completely sever that bond of trust, that existed.
I kind of wanted... I would like to see an alternate short story version of this book where that's the end. Is he just like, he just goes over it and works for IOI. Yeah, I was like, when I first saw that, I was like, is that like a LOL joke or something like that? Or is that supposed to be like
might
101?
Be a 101.
You know, depends on which font you're using. Serif or sans serif.
It does look cool in any case. Or I will admit, I'm like, oh, is that six in binary? I'm like, no, it is not God. Six in binary. It is five. So, you know, close, but I'm like, it would have been awesome if it was. See, that proves I would have been a Gunter of some kind.
Right? I'm pretty sure.
I have to say the first time they used the word Gunter, I couldn't help but think of the penguin from Adventure Time.
All right. Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Shame on you.
Well, I'm afraid
that was a reference to this.
I doubt
it. What was that before? When did that start? I don't know.
Adventure Time? I don't remember. It's like six seasons. It's like 2012 or something.
Yeah, I think it was after this.
So it's like, I suppose that could have been a reference to this, because I mean, Egg Hunter is an obvious, like, you know, horrible, like, you know, equivalent of weblog to blog, like, which I finally kind of gotten used to, but.
Yeah, it took you a while. I think it's time for us to leave this oasis of science fiction and rejoin the horrible trailer stack of ordinary reality.
I've actually set up a rig in the back.
I'm in. It's plugged directly into your unwrapped toys.
Ew.
So, we shall return, for we are sci-fi.
Sci-fi?
Sci-fi.